Job, Tape 9, Chapter 15 to Chapter 31, Second and Third Cycles of Debates.
I'll ask you to turn, please, to Job Chapter 15. Now, since the debates contain much sameness of content, that is, the same arguments are restated and rehashed over and over again. I feel that with the amount of revelation that I have on this, which is like a drop in the bucket, just one read, that it would be more profitable if I just sort of summarize, get the whole section before you, and then draw some practical principles. So rather than trying to analyze what did Eliphaz say, and how did Job answer him, and what did Bildad say, and how did Job answer him, and what was the argument of Zophar, and how did Job answer him, and then go through that again, I think it'll be more edifying if we just take it as a section, and then I hope that we'll be able to get some principles from it. So, the last time we finished the first round of debates, and remember, the main emphasis on the first round of debates was the character of God. The whole approach was God is holy, man is sinful. And Job, since God is holy, why don't you just admit it? You're sinful. They never did get to the root of Job's problem. When the debate started, his three friends had this idea. Job is guilty of some sin, we'll tell him about it, he'll confess it, everything will be alright. But when they started talking to Job, they found that he was a hard nut to crack. And he wouldn't admit any sin. So then they said, oh, it's a mental sin. And Job is covering it up, he doesn't want us to know. And they found that he was still a hard nut to crack. And so at the end of the debates, they said, well, he says he has no sin, but the statement, I have no sin, is sin. It's the sin of self-righteousness. And so they said, we got you here, Job. By you calling yourself innocent, you've declared yourself guilty, because that's the sin of self-righteousness. Now, I realize that the bulk of commentators point out the self-righteousness of Job. And if you read it on the surface, you're going to see, yes, Job was self-righteous. But if you get into the spirit of the book of Job, I don't believe his problem was self-righteousness. Now, of course, Job was a sinner, as all men are sinners. He was proud, as all men are proud. He was unbelieving, as all men are unbelieving. And he was self-righteous, as all of us are self-righteous. But not as the special source of the troubles that he was encountering. I don't believe, as I once did, that God was allowing all of this in Job so that God could reach down and take out that deep, deep rooted sin of self-righteousness. But Job was honest. Let me give an illustration. If I say, I'm faithful to my wife, I have no eyes for any other woman. I love her alone and I never desire another relationship. Is that self-righteousness? I don't think so. That's my real heart. That's how I feel inside. That's the truth. And by saying I'm true to my wife, I'm not denying the propensities of my wicked heart. I know the potential that's there. I've seen some godly men fall. And I'm not saying that my heart is perfect. But I am saying that I'm true to my wife. And I believe that that's what Job was saying. He's not saying that he's perfect. He's saying, I've been true to the Lord. My heart is right. I haven't rebelled against God. My will has been on the Lord. But I don't believe he's being self-righteous. I think he's being honest. He's saying, I did not rebel against God, and yet the bottom fell out of everything. All right, that brings us to the last two series of debates. Let me get it before you broadly, and then try to develop it as we go through. Let me erase this. The second of the three debates, I'll just use initial, Eliphaz speaks in chapter 15, and Job answers in chapter 16. Then Bildad speaks in chapter 17 as well. Bildad speaks in chapter 18, and Job answers in chapter 19. Then Zophar speaks in chapter 20, and Job answers in chapter 21. That's the second cycle. Then the third cycle, Eliphaz speaks again in chapter 22. Job is getting more long-winded now, as you see. And Job answers in chapter 23 and 24. Bildad speaks in chapter 25, and Job answers in chapter 26 through 31. And this is where people get the idea that Job was self-righteous. One commentator calls these the most self-righteous chapters in the entire Bible. And if you see these chapters, if you read them in one sitting, you'll see where they get that idea. Zophar doesn't even speak in this debate. He just gets all fed up and he quits the whole idea. Now, the second debate, let's begin here. The second debate, in the first debate, the main emphasis was God is holy, therefore you must be a sinner. In this series of debates, their chief emphasis is this: the wicked suffer. The fate of the wicked. And Job, just take a look at your life. Therefore, you must conclude with us that you're wicked. You see, because that's the fate of the wicked. And then in this third debate, they just pull out all the stops. And they don't give any metaphors or any figures of speech. They just come right out and say, Job, you are a dirty sinner. So there's a progress there, a subtle progress. God is great, you've sinned. The wicked suffer, you've sinned. Job, you just sinned. And they come right out and say it. Now, it may seem like a lot of ground to cover, since we're going to do, hopefully, chapter 15 through 31 this morning. So you better get on your track shoes. We're going to cover quite a bit of ground here. And I believe it'll be more edifying if we do it this way. I'm not qualified to go through this section verse by verse. An awful lot of human reasoning going on here. And I'm sure that there's a lot implied that I'm not familiar with. Let me give you a basic outline. Here's how I would like to approach it. First, I want to go through the facts of the debate. And I'm going to do it in story form. I'll just sort of tell the story. This is what Eliphaz said, and this is how Job felt about that. And I'll tell you the story. And I'll use isolated verses to illustrate it. And then when we're all done, I have about a dozen principles that I get from the whole section. And I like to share those with you. I'll just state those. And I think it'll be profitable. Okay, let's turn then, please, to chapter 15. Eliphaz is the first to speak. Eliphaz means God is gold. That's the meaning of his name. But he doesn't value the Lord like his name implies. Eliphaz is descendant from Esau, and that comes out in his character. He's definitely descendant from Esau. Even though Eliphaz is the oldest and the most dignified and the most considerate of all of Job's friends, this cycle of debates is going to illustrate that he's greatly annoyed. Now remember the chief problem. Job has a deep, deep problem in his soul. A problem that he made one great big mistake and he tried to verbalize it. He tried to express it. And since he couldn't express accurately the depth of his own desire, of his own soul, and since the three comforters heard only what came out of Job's mouth, these debates have been going around circles. Job said one thing, but meant another. And they were answering what they heard. They were answering his lips, not his heart. And the more he tried to explain, the deeper he got in. Did you ever get into a spot where the more you explain it, the worse it sounded? Well, that's how Job is. Job's in that position now. And the more he tries to explain, the more his lips sound rebellious. And it seems like the poison of asps is under his lips. Eliphaz is hot because of what he thinks is in Job's heart. Let me illustrate it. Eliphaz is annoyed at two main things as he begins this first speech. He's annoyed at the fact that Job is irreverent. Look at chapter 15, verse 4. Indeed, you do away with reverence and hinder meditation before God. Verse 12 and 13. Why does your heart carry you away? Why do your eyes flash that you should turn your spirit against God and allow such words to go out of your mouth? And so Eliphaz says, you are an irreligious, irreverent person. Don't you regard God? Aren't you afraid of Him? Why are you so rebellious? He's also angry at the fact that Job won't admit that he's a sinner. You're hiding your sin. You're a hypocrite, Job. Look at verse 5. Your gate teaches your mouth and you choose the language of the crafty. Job, you're just talking in circles and you're afraid to come right out and admit that you're a sinner. Now, in the last cycle of debates, Job suggested that these men were talking through their stovepipes, that they didn't have anything to offer. And I believe if you read chapter 15, you'll see that Eliphaz's feelings got a little hurt. His pride was a little hurt. After all, he was the eldest, and experience is the best teacher. And he was also a student. He had studied the writings of the ancients. And Job dared to call his wisdom hot air. Look at verses 9 and 10. What do you know that we do not know? What do you understand that we do not? Both the gray hair and the aged are among us, older than your father. Eliphaz had the idea that he and his two buddies were the mouthpiece of God. Look at verse 11. Are the consolations of God too small for you, even the words spoken gently with you? Job, we didn't come here for this. We came here to give you the consolations of God. We've been telling you God's will. We've been trying to be nice to you and explain to you that you're a sinner and you're getting all hot at us. Our words are the consolation of God. And it was shocking to Eliphaz, to his pride, to think that Job had contempt for their wisdom. The very idea, Job, this young upstart, he's not even dry behind the ears, telling us gray-haired old veterans, we know. And so he gets a bit sarcastic. The fact is, it's not a bit sarcastic. It's a biting sarcasm. It's chilling. Look at verses 7 and 8. Were you the first man to be born? Are you Adam? Were you brought forth before the hills? Did you hear the secret counsel of God and limit wisdom to yourself? Oh, tell us, Job. Were you the first one born? Are you Adam? When God was in the council declaring what he was going to do, were you behind the scenes listening in, Job? Tell us about that, how smart you are. his fluffed up feathers get cooled down a little bit. After he cools down over the audacity and the presumption of Job, then he gets down to his narrow argument. Eliphaz makes it plain that what he's about to say is not his own bright idea. This is the talk of the ancestors. This is what the books have said. This is tradition. Verse 17 through 19, I will tell you, listen to me. And what I've seen, I will also declare. What wise men have told and have not concealed from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, and no alien passed among them. In other words, what he's saying is, Job, I'm going to tell you something, and I didn't make it up. This is wisdom, and it's the talk of the ancestors. They've had this forever. And no stranger came in either and diluted the truth. This is the plain, unadulterated truth. And here it is. You've heard it before. The wicked suffer, Job, and you're suffering, therefore, ergo, you're wicked. His argument is basically that, but he divides it up into three facts. First, he says, the conscience of the wicked is troubled every day. Verse 20 and 21, the wicked man writhes in pain all his days, and numbered are the years stored up for the ruthless. Sounds of terror are in his ears, or at peace the destroyer comes upon him. Job, the wicked have a guilty conscience. They toss back and forth. Verse 24, distress and anguish terrify him. They overpower him like a king ready for the attack, because he stretched out his hand against God and conducts himself arrogantly against the Almighty. And then he says, not only does the conscience bother the wicked, but the wicked always come to poverty, Job. Verse 28, he has lived in desolate cities and houses no one would inhabit, which are destined to become ruins. He will not become rich, nor will his wealth endure. His grain will not bend down to the ground. He will not escape darkness. The flame will wither his shoots. Take a look at your life, Job. That's what happens to the wicked. And then in verse 32 through 34, he says the wicked always die a premature death. And Job, you're a dying man. Verse 32, it will be accomplished before his time. His palm branch will not be green. He'll drop off his unripe grape like the vine, and cast off his flower like the olive tree. For the company of the godless is barren. Fire consumes the tent of the corrupt. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity, and their mind prepares deception. Well, Job responds to Bildad's accusation. You're wicked, Job. You're very wicked. In verse chapter 16 and 17, since he's already answered that old argument proposed by Eliphaz, he sort of ignores it this time. He thinks it's useless listening to these guys. He's getting weary of empty speeches. He reminds them of that in verse 2 and 3. I've heard many things, many such things. Sorry comforters are you all. Is there no limit to windy words? Or what plagues you that you answer? You see, Job is sort of on the spot now. Eliphaz says, the wicked have a guilty conscience. Job says, my conscience is not guilty. Eliphaz says, the wicked lose all their wealth. And Job says, I've lost my wealth. Eliphaz says, the wicked die. They're coming to a premature death. And Job is dying. And so Job, he says, it's senseless to try to reconcile before these fellows the fact that his conscience is not guilty, that he's innocent, and yet he's lost his wealth, and he's losing his health, and he's dying. It's a losing battle. And besides, even if he could answer successfully Eliphaz's argument, his heart would still have empty spaces. He's not satisfied because his problem is deeper than that. They're giving him theology, doctrine, creed, the depravity of man, the knowledge of God, the justice of God, universal conscience. Job didn't need a dissertation on those things. His perplexity was that his best friend God turned against him for no apparent reason. And this God, whom he trusted, whom he honored, whom he served, and the fact is, whom he loved, had for some reason placed Job between the hammer and the anvil. And Job didn't know why. Chapter 16, 7 through 16, he just sort of blurts out. This is his real problem. Now he has exhausted me. Thou hast laid waste all my company. If you notice, this is a prayer now. He's not saying to Bildad, he has. He's saying to God, thou hast. He's praying. Thou hast shriveled me up, and it has become a witness, and my leanness rises up against me. It testifies to my face. Then he turns to Bildad and says, his anger has torn me and hunted me down. He's gnashed at me with his teeth. My adversary glares at me. They've gaped at me with their mouth. They've slapped me on the cheek with contempt. They've massed themselves against me. God hands me over to ruffians, tosses me into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he shattered me. He has grasped me by the neck and shaken me to pieces. He has also set me up as his target. His arrows surround me. Without mercy, he splits my kidneys open and pours out my gall on the ground. He breaks through me with breach after breach. He runs at me like a warrior. I've sewed sackcloth over my skin, thrust my horn in the dust. My face is flushed from weeping. Deep darkness is on my eyelids. Although, there's no violence in my hands and my prayer is pure. God has come against me. And his frustration was, I haven't done a thing. I don't know why. If you would only tell me why. Job's frustration was that he was alone on the earth. God had abandoned him. And then God had withheld wisdom from these guys so that they also alienated him. Job knows that his heart is right. And he refuses to let go of the one thing he has left. Innocence. He knows his heart is right. He knows he hasn't done anything. And yet it's hopeless to argue that point with these guys. And he was finding it increasingly hopeless to call upon God. You see his frustration? By the end of chapter 16 and the beginning of chapter 17, Job has thrown in the towel. He's ready to die. Chapter 17, 1 and 2. My spirit is broken. My days are extinguished. The grave is ready for me. Surely mockers are with me, and my eye gazes on their provocation. That he's talking about. See, these guys said, if you repent, you'll live. And he says, I have nothing to repent of. And I know your promise of life is stupid. You can't promise me life. God has set me up as an enemy. I'm going to die. There's no getting out of it. And And so he had every reason to believe that he was going to die. He numbered with the transgressors. His spirit was broken. Remember what Proverbs 17:22 says about a broken spirit? It says, a broken spirit drieth up the bones. Boy, it ever does. Now you get somebody whose spirit's broken, and you got a person that's ready to die. But Job is so certain that he's innocent, so determined that he's right. He holds tenaciously to that truth that he's in his integrity, his righteousness, that he has this assurance, his righteousness will not be hidden forever. His innocent blood will never stop crying to God unceasingly. His blood's going to appeal to God until one day a righteous God finally vindicates him and his blood finds a response. Look at verse 18 and 19 of chapter 16. Oh, do not cover my blood. Let there be no resting place for my cry. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, my advocate is on high. It's sort of a pathetic scene. Job feels abandoned and he doesn't know why. God has rejected him and man has rejected him. And he's finally come to the place, he says, I know I'm going to die, but I'm innocent. And one day, whether it's here in my life or whether it's after I'm dead, one day my blood will cry out and God will vindicate me. God will show the world that I'm right. It's a pathetic scene. Look at chapter 16, verse 20. Job lifts his tear-filled eyes to God. My friends are my scoffer. My eye weeps to God. He looks up to a God that he thinks is unjustly bringing him to death. But he has a hope that even after he's dead and after worms destroy his body, one day, will be vindicated. One day everyone will know that he was right. He doesn't have any hope for this life. Look at chapter 17, 10 through 16. Come again, all of you now. I do not find a wise man among you. My days are past. My plans are torn apart. Even the wishes of my heart. They make night into day, saying, the light is near, in the presence of darkness. If I look for Sheol as my home, I make my bed in the darkness. If I call to the pit, you're my father, to the worm, my mother, and my sister. Where now is my hope? Who regards my hope? Will it go down with me to Sheol? Shall we together go down into the dust? He has no hope for living. And yet, verse 9, he refuses to give an inch. Nevertheless, the righteous shall hold to his way. He who has clean hands shall grow stronger and stronger. And Job says, I know you don't understand this, gentlemen. I know your theology. The wicked suffer, I'm suffering, therefore I'm wicked. I reject your theology. I can't explain it. I can't convince you of it. I know I've done nothing. I know I'm not wicked. I know I'm right. My prayer is pure. And I know what's come upon me has come from God. And I've cried out for him to say why. I've called upon him to come and face me like a man. And he refuses to listen. And so I have one choice. Since God is too strong for me, I must die. And die I will. But I'm going to go into the grave saying, I'm right, and you're wrong. And one day I have the assurance that God, who is holy, will vindicate me somehow. I don't know how, but I know he will. That's how Job feels. And he feels like that's going to end his discussion. The argument's ended. He sinks back into his bed, and he says it's all over. Job feels like a man who's lost his wife. They're giving arguments. Why did she leave? He says, I don't care why she left. She's gone. That's what bothers me. You're not going to help me by telling me why. And so he feels like that's the end of it. He's already closed the argument. He says, it's all over. I'm going to die. I plan to die. It's all over. I'm not going to confess anything. You guys are just beating the wind. Forget it. But these good physicians won't let it lie there. Bildad now has to add his 2 cents. Job keeps trying to quit this debate and they keep dragging him back into it. Chapter 18. Job speaks in ruthless severity. Job has given up. His spirit is broken. He doesn't want to argue anymore. He doesn't want to fight God. He doesn't want to fight man. The only thing he really wants is the only one who can solve the problem, God, to come solve it, or else just let him die and then someday it'll be vindicated. But Bildad won't let it die. Like Eliphaz, Bildad's pride was hurt. Chapter 18, verse 3. Why are we regarded as beasts? As stupid in your eyes. That's the only thing bothering him. You don't accept my counsel. I'm so smart. He thinks Job is expecting too much from God. Verse 4. Oh, you who tear yourself in your anger, for your sake is the earth to be abandoned or the rock to be moved from its place. In other words, he's saying, God, this is Bildad, God has established certain unchangeable laws, and he's not going to change them for you, Job. And what is God's unchangeable law according to Bildad? Here we go again. The wicked suffer, you suffer, therefore you're wicked. I won't bore you with Bildad's speech. I'll take the terminal points to illustrate it. Chapter 18, verse 5. Indeed, the light of the wicked goes out. And then he describes the wicked. And then the last verse, 21. So such are the dwellings of the wicked. This is the place of him who does not know God. In other words, Bildad has done exactly what everyone before him has done. Except, he says, Job, God's not going to change his plan for you. Here's his plan. The wicked suffer, you're wicked. I mean, you're suffering, therefore you're wicked. And so, whether he likes it or not, Job is back in the debate. This is Bildad in chapter 19. I don't think Bildad appreciated the answer. His answer goes something like this. You see it in those first verses. Okay, says Job to Bildad, let's take your unchanging principle of God. The wicked suffer, I'm suffering, therefore I'm wicked. Here's how it comes across to me. The wicked suffer, I suffer, I'm innocent, therefore, verse 6. Know then that God has wronged me. And he's closed his net around me. God goofed. The principle didn't hold, Job. The wicked suffer. I suffer. I'm innocent. Therefore, there's only one conclusion. And that is, God is to be blamed. Job is angry with Bildad. Angry and frustrated, both. He's deeply pained that they think he's a hypocrite, harboring some sin in his life. And he knows it's futile to keep explaining his position. Besides, his real problem is too deep to express. All Job wants is an answer from God. He knows God's real, and he knows God's up there, and he knows God's listening. But God won't answer. Look at verse 7. Behold, I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there's no justice. He's walled up my way so that I cannot pass. He's put darkness on my paths. He's stripped my honor from me, removed the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side and I'm gone. He's uprooted my hope like a tree. He's kindled his anger against me and considered me as his enemy. His troops came together and built up their way against me and camp around my tent. He doesn't understand why God gives him the deaf ear. Job says, only God can solve my problems, not you. I only want one thing from you, man, he says, and it isn't answered. Verse 21 and 22. Pity me. Pity me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. He says, all I want from you is a little pity. All I want from you is a little understanding. Just a little sympathy. I'm not asking you to help me out of my problem. There's only one person that can explain that. That's God, and he won't do it. And I don't know why. And then he sinks back again in despair. And in verse 23 through 29, he just says, what's the use? What's the use? Oh, that my words were written, that they were inscribed in a book, that with an iron stylus and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. As for me, I knew that my Redeemer lives. See, he's never lost faith. He believes in God with all his heart. He says, though he slay me, I'll trust. But he expects to die. He says, I know my Redeemer lives. And at the last, he'll take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is frayed, yet without my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, whom my eyes shall see, and not another. My heart faints within me. He said, I know that I'll be vindicated someday, even if it's after this life. Job is stubborn. He won't yield. And so Zophar says, I'm going to add some light to all of this. Like the others, Zophar is also irritated. You see, Job ended his discussion with Bildad with this suggestion, verse 29. Be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so you may know that there's judgment. Job ended his answer to Bildad with a suggestion that God might strike them down the same way he struck down Job. And old Zophar didn't like that insinuation because that would make him a sufferer and the wicked suffer, and therefore he would be wicked, and he didn't like that. Zophar's great contribution to this confusion can be summarized in these words. Chapter 20, verse 5. The triumphing of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless momentary. Verse 8. He flies away like a dream, and they cannot find him. Verse 23. When he fills his belly, God will send his fierce anger on him. It will rain on him while he's eating. In other words, nothing new. The wicked suffer. Look at verse 29. This is the wicked man portion from God, the heritage decreed to him by God. These guys won't get off their argument. The wicked suffer. Job, you're suffering. You must be wicked. Job answers in 21, since you drag me back into the argument, okay, I'll try to explain. I don't want to fight anymore. 21:3, bear with me that I may speak, then after I've spoken you may mock. All right, he says, I'll try again. And then Job gives an unanswerable observation. This is the beginning of shutting their mouths when he says this. Chapter 21. I'm going to read a number of these verses. Starting in verse 7. You know, you guys, you've told me about the wicked suffer, I've heard that till it's coming out my ears. Now, verse 7. Why do the wicked still live? Continue on. Also become very powerful. Their descendants are established with them in their soul. Their offspring before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear. Neither is the rod of God on them. His ox mates without fail. His cows calve and does not abort. They send forth their little ones like the flock, and their children skip about. They sing to the timbrel and the harp. They rejoice at the sound of the flute. They spend their days in prosperity and suddenly go down to Sheol. They say to God, depart from us. We do not even desire the knowledge of thy ways. Who's the Almighty that we should serve him? And what would we gain if we entreat him? Behold, their prosperity is not in their hand. Their counsel of the wicked is far from me. How often is the lamp of the wicked put out, or calamity fall on them? Does God apportion destruction in his anger? Are they as straw before the wind, like chaff which the storm carries away? You say God stores away a man's iniquity for his son. Let God repay him so he may know it. Let his own eyes see decay, etc., etc. Job says, really? The wicked suffer? Tell me about it. I got some wicked neighbors and they're not suffering. And I know a lot of wicked people that don't suffer. Where do you get this idea? The wicked suffer. God cuts them off. The wicked are always poor and the wicked are always diseased. So where'd you get that idea? That's unanswerable. Now, by the way, you'll notice in the top of the New American Standard in bold print, it says, Job, and then there's a quote, the wicked are like straw before the wind. Job never said that. That's a misprint. You see, if you read the context, verse 18, are they as straw before the wind, like the chaff which the storm carries away? His answer is no, they're not. Job isn't saying the wicked are like straw. He's saying they're not like straw before the wind. I wish that they were, but they're not. Job doesn't deny that the wicked are going to be punished. But verse 30, the wicked is reserved for the day of calamity. He knows the wicked is going to be punished someday, but not this life. In the life to come. So the second cycle of debates ends. They can't answer that observation Job made. The whole argument's gone up in smoke. The wicked suffer, they said. And Job says, really? That's not all I see. Look around. All right, let me get the facts of the third debate. I see we'll be stretched into this for another study, I think. Let me get the facts before you in this third debate. This is the heaviest siege of all. It goes from chapter 22 through 31. This time, there are no innuendos, no insinuations, no vague metaphors or generalizations. Eliphaz begins, chapter 22. Let's look at verse 5. This time he doesn't say the wicked suffer. He says, is not your wickedness great, and your iniquities without end? You have taken pledges of your brothers without cause, and stripped men naked. To the weary you have given no water to drink. From the hungry you have withheld bread. But the earth belongs to the mighty man, and the honorable man dwells in it. You have sent widows away empty, The strength of orphans has been crushed. Therefore snares surround you. Sudden dread terrifies you, of darkness so that you cannot see. An abundance of water covers you. Oh, how this must have broken the heart of Job to hear these things from the mouth of his former friend, Eliphaz. He comes right out and says, you've crushed the orphan and you've turned away the widow, and he begins to name sins. You talk about judging a man's heart. Eliphaz says, I don't care what you observed about the prosperity of the wicked. It's not true. The principle remains. And it looks like in verses 12 through 20, he says, and I'm even going to hold God to that principle. And his conclusion is, verse 21, yield now and be at peace with him. You better repent. And he goes back to his same old argument. The wicked suffer. You're suffering. You're wicked. Isn't it amazing how blind people can be? He's a lot more rational than Eliphaz was, and that's illustrated in his response in chapters 23 and 24. Again, he first expresses the depths of his heart. He doesn't want answers. He wants God. Verse 3, chapter 23:3. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I'd learn the words that he would answer and perceive what he would say to me. Would he contend with me by the greatness of his power? No, surely he'd pay attention to me. There the upright could reason with him, and I'd be delivered forever from my judge. Behold, I go forward, but he's not there, and backward, but I cannot perceive him. When he acts on the left, I cannot behold him. He turns on the right, I cannot see him. See what Job is saying? Oh, if I only could get... Why won't he listen? Why won't he come? He's the only one that has the answer. And he won't listen. If only I could find him. If only we could get together. If only he would come and answer me. Verse 10. He knows the way I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. What a marvelous verse. Job knows there's a reason. He's not rebelling against that. It's the perplexity in his heart. He's not crying because he lost his children, or his gold, or his cattle, or his houses, or even his health. He's not complaining about the physical suffering. He's complaining because God is gone, and he doesn't know where to find him. He knows he can't resist the Lord. Verse 13, he's unique. Who can tell him? What his soul desires, that he does. He performs what's appointed for me. Many such decrees are with him. And he asks again, I won't go through the whole chapter, it's chapter 24. Why, verse 2, are some, and then if you read those verses, you'll see what he's talking about, while others, verse 13, why are some wicked men blessed and other righteous men allowed to suffer? And then in verse 25, he says, and now if it's not so, who can prove me a liar and make my speech worthless? You say the wicked suffer. I say they don't. Not always. Sometimes they do, but not always. Why do some while others. And Job says, if I'm wrong, you tell me about that. This is the mystery of providence. Have you ever asked the question? Let me just digress from Job for a moment here. Matter of fact, in my study of Luke, I found an interesting verse. Turn to Luke 13, just for a moment. I won't spend much time on this digression, because I want to get into Job. But Jesus gave this wonderful illustration. Luke 13, beginning at verse 1. Now, on that same occasion, there were some present who had reported to him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate mingled with their sacrifices. And he answered and said to them, do you suppose that these Galileans were greater sinners than the other Galileans because they suffered this fate? 4. Do you suppose that those 18 on whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them were worse culprits than all the men who live in Jerusalem? Why did that tower fall and kill those 18 people? Because they were more wicked? Jesus says, I tell you no. What a mess. Why did that airplane crash? That God would have judgment on those that were? Jesus says, I tell you no. Matthew 5:45 says, he causes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good. And he sends rain upon the righteous and upon the unrighteous. God has established certain laws of nature. He can change them, but he seldom does. If anyone, whether they're Christian or non-Christian, violates those laws, they're going to be hurt. Fire, and gravity, and sea currents, and exposure, these are laws of God. God does not exempt his children from suffering. Recently, you remember, down south, there was a Bible school. And there was a dam, and the dam broke. And God didn't stop that water just because a Bible school was in front of that dam. And many people lost their lives. Here's what God does. Without violating the will, one might choose to build in front of that dam or stand under that tower or get on that airplane. Someone drives their car, gets hit by a drunk driver, someone else gets cancer, some other disease. Here's what God does. What part does God have in it? God rules and overrules. All things work together for good. He changes the curse into a blessing. He turns it around for good. He uses those things to perform his own will. He works out his purposes. But we're not puppets. We're not marionettes. He's not pulling strings. His people are not by remote control. He's not guiding us that way. Romans 8:28 is true. The material blessings fall on the just and on the unjust. And the wicked sometimes are blessed because God's reserved a day of judgment for them. Anyway, back to Job. Bildad must speak once more. It's a short chapter, but he's got to get in the last word. And here's what it boils down to. I'm talking about chapter 25. You see how short it is. And it boils down to this. Job, I can't answer your argument, but I still think you're a dirty sinner. That's his argument. I can't answer you, Job, but I still think you're a dirty sinner. Then Job gives one of the longest of his discourses, chapter 26 through 31. Now that everyone has shut up, see, the debates are over, he gets a little softer. And he says, been asking you about deep things, and I know you can't answer those. Only God can answer those. But I presented some problems, and you couldn't even answer the surface things. So he says, let me answer the surface things, first of all. First of all, he says, verses 5 through 14 of chapter 26, I have a large view of God. And boy, you begin to read that description of God, and he really does, probably larger than Bildad and Zophar and Eliphaz. And he says, but that doesn't change my position. Chapter 27, 1 through 6. As God lives, who has taken away my life, as the Almighty who has embittered my soul, for as long as life is in me and breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips certainly will not speak unjustly, nor will my tongue mutter deceit. Far be it from me that I should declare you right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness. I will not let it go. My heart does not reproach any of my days. He said, I have a high view of God, and I don't understand it all, but I know this. I refuse to say that I've sinned. That is not why I'm going through this. I know, he said. Verse 11, I'll instruct you in the power of God. What is the Almighty? What is with the Almighty? I will not conceal. I'll tell you what I think, he says. And then he begins to give answers on the level of earth. You say the wicked don't get rich. Here's what I say, verse 14. Though his sons are many, they're destined for the sword. His descendants will not be satisfied with bread. Or they'll get rich, but they won't be satisfied with their riches. The survivors will be buried because of the plague, and the widows will not be able to weep. Though he piles up silver like dust, he'll get rich. And prepares garments as plentiful as the clay, he'll get rich. He may prepare, but the just will wear it. The innocent will divide the silver. He won't enjoy it. They talked about physical things. Chapter 28, 1 through 11. You want to see how smart Job is? We won't take time to read this. Boy, does he have a knowledge of geology. He's been talking about gold and silver and riches and wealth. I'll tell you about it. I know more about it than you do, he says. And he illustrates that in the first 11 verses. But then he says, I'm not talking about gold and silver and being rich or not being rich. I don't care about losing my money. I'm not complaining about my crosses and my losses. Verse 12, where can wisdom be found? That's what I'm after. Verse 14, the deep says it's not in me. The sea says it's not with me. Pure gold cannot be given in exchange for it, nor can silver be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir. Its precious onyx or sapphire, gold or glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for articles of fine gold. Coral and crystal are not to be mentioned. The acquisition of wisdom is above that of pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. He said, all of you have been talking about gold, and the rich are poor, and the righteous are rich. I'm not talking about gold. Gold can't buy wisdom. I know I lost my money, and I know I lost my house, and I know I lost my kids, and I lost my health, but there's something deeper than that. And that's what my heart cries out for, he says. I want wisdom. And you don't buy that with gold and with silver. He says in verse 23 through 28, I know he knows. I know he knows. he finally sinks into his final despair. Chapter 29, we won't take time, the time is gone. Chapter 29, he reminisces. Oh, I remember when I was walking with God. Chapter 30, he says, but look at me now. And chapter 31, he says, there has been no reason for this. No reason that I know of. Look at verse 35 of chapter 31. This is final sigh now. The arguments are over. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Behold, there's my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. And the indictment which my adversary has written, surely I would bind it on my shoulder and bind it to myself like a crown. I would declare to him the number of my steps. Like a prince I would approach him. If only God would come out of hiding, I'd come right up before him and I'd say, Lord, here I am. You know the heart, you know me inside out. Why have you allowed this in my life? I know it's not because I've sinned. Chapter 32, verse 1. Then these three men ceased answering Job, because he was righteous in his own eyes. The debates are ended. Job sinks back in his pillow, waiting for only one thing. Death. It's at the end of these debates that God begins to move. And we'll pick that up next time. Comments or questions about these debates? We didn't get into the principles. I got 12 principles to give you about this. We'll pick that up next time. I don't think the facts would take that long to get across. But let's bow. Our Father, we do thank you for the book of Job. And we think how often we're put into the same situation. Where you're doing a secret work that we don't know anything about in our lives or in the lives of our friends. Lord, deliver us from fleshly interference while you're trying to do your work. We thank you for the book of Job and we pray that you'd instruct us as we study this book. We know ultimately, when we pass through the book, we're going to see the real full answer, a vision of El Shaddai. In Jesus' name.